Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, a show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is my co-host with the most, Mr. Spencer Awesome Writer Williams.
Okay. I'll go with that.
It's getting difficult coming up with key things to say that aren't so demeaning that's going to break the morale of this podcast.
Yeah,
so,
you know, I thought you would have ran out of names like over like 2 years ago, but here
never.
We are.
Never. Are you kidding? This is one of the best parts of the actual job. and speaking of part of the job...
I
didn't know where I was going.
No one could tell where you were going.
I literally took a left turn from Albuquerque and was like, where am I going? We also have with us intern / part-timer / stenographer, Amy.
Yes, still an intern.
Still an intern, still an ensign, still part-time.
And Lieutenant Commander.
And still not bringing that coffee.
what?
We got a great show in store as we are going to be talking about one of the smash hit films of the beginning of this year. And that is American Fiction. So stick around as we dive into that conversation. But before we do, Spencer, give us them opening credits.
Tune in each and every Thursday.
We try.
On all your favorite streaming platforms and over our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
And Threads at filmlosophy101. I know, we keep forgetting to put that in there. Yes.
Pack of stuff that needs to go into this list now.
That's right. We got a website. Head on over to filmlosophers.com where we have allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, thrillers. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlosophers.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, or iHeart. You can tune into any one of those places. Tune into your heart's desire, that is. Follow us there at The Filmlosophers. Give us a follow or subscribe. Let us know how we're doing and drop us a comment in the towel section down below. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned that.
We have.
Yes, indeed.
That's right. We'll give you the social links at the end of the episode. Boy. No, just kidding.
Okay. That happened.
No. Before we jump into our main conversation of the evening, which we are all so very much excited to talk about, as if you didn't listen to last week's episode where we talked about the best of 2023, this movie, to kind of foreshadow how the rest of this conversation is going to go, was technically Spencer's favorite of 2023. Mm-hmm. So we're excited to talk about it. I know I'm excited to talk about it. But before we do, we need to address a couple things in the Hollywood industry. And that is all going to take place within our movie news. Yes.
Yes. That was brilliant.
Movie news. Yes, we have stuff to talk about. And honestly, I think with everything going on in the world, let's just look at some dumb stuff. And I think the most ridiculous new piece of Hollywood movie news out there right now is this debacle between Pauly Shore and Richard Simmons.
I'm sorry, what?
So apparently, Pauly Shore has been campaigning for a while now that he could do, he's been campaigning for this, that he could aptly and very astutely play Richard Simmons in a Richard Simmons biopic.
Isn't Richard Simmons still alive?
He is very much still alive. I don't think that man will ever die. In fact,
he's a healthy fellow. He's
and so apparently earlier today, Wednesday, the 17th of January, Pauly Shore made news by announcing that he will, in fact, be playing Richard Simmons in an upcoming biopic about the health guru's life and his career in the starlight.
But he's not dead.
Now, that's the interesting part about this is that Richard Simmons, a few hours later, went to social media and said, I have not been spoken to nor given given permission to do this biopic. Don't believe everything you read. Now, here's the thing. I don't know what Richard Simmons is currently doing as of right now. Maybe he's like doing some kind of yoga studio in like somewhere in Arizona or something. I feel like he's the more flamboyant Bob Ross of our youth. I mean, honestly, if you think about it, that hair. I mean, it's a lot.
And he also promotes movement and exercise for everybody. Like, if there's anybody that's a champion of just staying healthy by just continuing to move, just do it to your own beat, it is Richard Simmons 100%.
Well, not just that, but the man has a really good attitude about, you know, humor. And he's been in several different, like, parodies. He's been in things that have made fun of, not so much made fun of, but was satirical about, like, the workouts that Richard Simmons used to do, you know, sweating to the oldies, sweating to, well, all these kinds of things. You know, and he has a good heart about it. He's humorous about it. He knows that he's having fun and everybody is having fun with him. No one is laughing at him. They are all laughing with him. Mm-hmm. And he has that about him. He has that temperament. Whatever Pauly Shore did or didn't do in this case that got him to the point to where he had to, like, I could visually see it, him stamping effeminately his foot into the ground. It's like, no, I'm going to, like, I forget how Richard Simmons sounds, but I remember as a youth, it's like one of those things like riding a bike. The moment you hear it again, it's like all the memories flood back. But I do think it is an interesting point that you bring up, Amy, regarding the fact that, yes, he is still alive. So technically the biopic should have went through his people.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is, I went to the interwebs. Nobody's really kind of seen him since 2016. Like, he's just removed himself from the public view. He's trying to stay out of the public eye. And apparently he has been dealing with, like, in 2018, he sued a private investigator who put a tracking device on his car. In July of 2018, amended it because they were hired by InTouch Weekly to find him.
Ooh.
In 2022, he responded to continuing rumors from a TMZ documentary, What Really Happened to Richard Simmons, claiming that a knee problem forced him out of public life, and he had to issue a statement to the Post. So this is like somebody is pretending that I'm saying Richard Simmons is 75, alive. His publicist and he are both like, nope, we're still here, we're totally fine, just don't.
And I think it just comes to a point to where, like, you consider the whole situation with paparazzis. There has to be a point where people should just be like left alone. Yeah. Like, I get it. He was everything that he was, as, you know, when we were younger. He was loud, he was boisterous, he was peppy, he was, you know, he was all these things. And that's not necessary. I'm not saying those are bad things. I'm just saying these are the things that he was. So now that he's in that age where he's just trying to just live a life, why are these people still trying to find, like, if he doesn't want to be found, then leave him alone. Like, there should be a cap for, like, certain celebrities. If they just, if they're done with the industry, then just leave them be. Like, put them on a do not call list.
Okay, that's not how Hollywood works.
I know.
I don't even work in the industry, and I know that.
No, obviously.
They are vultures. If they even smell as much as, like, a little piece of meat on your carcass, they will peck you until you are beneath the ground.
Wow. Well, if this makes you feel better.
Who wronged you?
Apparently, in February of 2017, there was a podcast, an investigative journalism podcast, called Missing Richard Simmons, where, no joke, somebody from, like, I guess he was a former producer on The Daily Show, like, went to go find out why he had disappeared, as well as, like, legitimately interviewing, like, trying to find Richard Simmons, but Richard Simmons' housekeeper, his friend and masseuse, Richard's brother, and then a student and a friend of Richard Simmons for over 40 years, like, where did he go? What happened? And I'm like, the man just wants to be left alone.
Yeah.
Like, he's been in the public eye since forever. And as long as he's okay, I'm like, just, you do your thing, bud. Do it.
Especially if you're somebody, like, he dedicated. Here's one thing. If that was Richard Simmons's, like, just persona, the way he was constantly 100%, then, you know what, he did a great job. He's living life to the fullest. His career was, you know, everything that I hoped his career was everything that he had wanted to be. If that was a bit, like, if everything he was doing on camera and in the public was a bit, That man burned the candle at both ends. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's not to say that even if it wasn't, he didn't work hard. He still works hard. To carry that amount of like energy and just perpetuate that all the time, that has to be taxing at some point in time. And I don't know. I feel like above all else, number one, first off, Pauly Shore, back off. Because obviously Richard Simmons doesn't want...
Father, he wants to go out on his own.
Okay. About Pauly Shore. Just back off of everything for a bit.
Just a little.
You did Pinocchio last year. You're good for the next 6 months.
Look, it's the Leaning Tower of Jesus.
I can't be mad at a Goofy movie reference. But no, yes, I agree with Spencer. This is, you were in the public eye resurgence with your memeages of you being in that Pinocchio movie.
Yeah.
We don't know. Leave Richard Simmons alone.
Or at least just be respectful. You know, if you're going to go through those, if you're going to try to build something or honor somebody, do it the respectful way. Do it through the right avenues and make sure that you're getting every I dotted and T crossed. Because honestly, at this point in time, it just sounds like Richard Simmons just wants to be alone. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's no problem with it. And I feel like we should all just give it a little bit of time for him just to enjoy the life that he has right now. So, and I'm pretty sure that there's a lot of other things that are going to come about as of late because of that. And we'll keep our ear to the ground. Not that this is like I said, this isn't exactly the smartest of movie news, but it's still important, you know, and it's still worth mentioning that with all the information out there right now, all the conversations about paparazzis and privacy and respecting that, it goes as well to the industry, you know, at first. If you want to see that kind of change, be the change. And if it has to start within Hollywood, then so be it. Like, force those issues, force those conversations to be had.
Well, then it also brings up the questions of, like, when a star or a celebrity chooses, even in their older age, to remove themselves from the public eye, like, not only is the question of, like, where does celebrity stop for them, but when someone's like, I'm going to be playing you in a movie, and the person is, one, alive, two, their estate hasn't sold the rights to anybody, and they're like, no, I didn't say that. Like, yeah. That would be someone doing the same thing with Carl Reiner, R.I.P., or Mel Brooks, who is still alive and kicking. If somebody's like, I'm portraying Mel Brooks in the Mel Brooks autobiography. Like, no, the guy's still there. Like, stop it. Yeah. Leave him alone. He gets to pick. It's
so,
his life.
So we'll see where this conversation leads and who else is going to lend their voice to it. And obviously, if the right decisions are made, then people will reach out to the other people. And if it's a definitive no, then guess what? It's a definitive no. Mm-hmm. So. But speaking of not no, that does bring us to our SIGGOOs, guys.
SIGGOOs.
SIGGOOs. That does bring us to our conversation of the evening, and that is our thoughts and review on Cord Jefferson's American Fiction. So this movie was actually quite interesting, pertaining to everything that it did and didn't do, which are all great things. And it's weird because I'm going to have a really hard time kind of explaining this movie, because I was trying to explain it to someone else today who had never seen it or even seen a trailer. And they're like, well, what kind of sentiment did you get from this movie? And I'm like, that's a hard question. Mm-hmm. So
I have the same problem at work today. Someone else asked me about it too, and I was like, it's good.
I don't really know where else to go from this. So before I go any further, Spencer, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness?
Monk, a frustrated novelist who's fed up with the establishment profiting from quote-unquote black entertainment, relies on tired and offensive tropes. To prove his point, Monk uses a pen name to write an outlandish quote-unquote black book of his own, a book that prepares him to the heart of a hypocrisy and the madness he claims to disdain.
Written and directed by Cord Jefferson, the film stars Jeffrey Wright, Tracy Ellis Ross, John Ortiz, Erica Alexander, Leslie Uggams, Adam Brody with Issa Rae, and Sterling K. Brown. A couple key pieces of information This is actually director Cord Jefferson's directorial debut.
Yay.
And this is also the first film from Orion Pictures and MGM to win the People's Choice Award at the Toronto International Film Festival. So that's cool. That's saying something about Orion Pictures, mostly because Orion Pictures doesn't really do a lot of movies as of late. I'm trying to think now.
Well, because like I remember when I saw their logo, I was like, I have not seen this logo
in years, right? Yeah. It wasn't just me.
Yeah. Another key piece of information, the movie is based upon the book Erasure by Percival Everett, which at this table, Spencer did read the book.
Yep, Sped read the audiobook today.
There's one of us.
Yeah, I was actually like kicking myself because we were coming to the studio and I'm like, man, I wanted to read the book. I wanted to like dive into it and make sure I got some. And I was like, I got to the studio and I'm like, dang it. I was feeling bad. And then Spencer's like, oh yeah, by the way, I read the book. I'm like, yes, someone read the book. Thank God. And then last but not least, although there's plenty of jazz on the soundtrack, none of it is actually by Thelonious Monk, after whom the lead character is nicknamed for. So I thought that was a little fun piece of trivia for that, because I don't know if any of you have actually ever listened to Thelonious Monk.
Mm-hmm. When I saw that piece of trivia, I then loaded up some of his music into the thing.
So, but yeah, this was a very interesting movie for kind of breaking into the 2024 year. Even though it was technically released in a limited run back in December of last year, so that way it could make it for the awards campaigning season right now. But yeah, to say that this is a complex movie is underselling it. Yeah, I don't want to jump into the review right away, because it's like I want to start talking about this, but like I have to, you know, go through. So one thing we're gonna do, we are gonna mention that there are gonna be spoilers. We're gonna mention spoilers in this movie. So if you haven't seen this film,
please turn this off and go see this film. Just that's it.
Yeah, it's definitely a great movie, and we want to make sure that you get as much of that full experience as possible. However, for us to kind of deep dive into everything that we've seen, we do need to kind of go over a couple of certain aspects and pieces to make sure that the conversation is well-rounded. So you've been warned. First, last, and only warning, spoiler alert. Let's talk expectations. Now, in terms of expectations, I know that we have all seen the trailer. And then, Spencer, you didn't read the book until after watching the movie, right?
Yes.
Okay, so ultimately, we're just going in with the fact that, number one, it's a movie that stars Jeffrey Wright.
Mm-hmm.
And that Sterling K. Brown was very, very excited about the film to come out. After an interview he did with Sean Hayes with the Hot Ones on YouTube, he really was excited for people to go out and see that movie. So those are the only two things that I was aware of. So let's go and go around the table and start with Amy. Expectations.
That pretty much was it. I had a vague kind of understanding watching the trailer that there was going to be exploration of an author, but not really enough for me to create an expectation.
Well, then let me do this, because with the limited amount of knowledge that we do have, I kind of want to switch platforms here from the movie itself to you're a reader. You're somebody who likes to read, as well as the rest of us here, obviously. What are some of your takes on the novels of, like, you know, the novels of more recently coming out that are kind of all over the place in terms of, you know, YA, you know, romance, things like that? Where do you feel kind of the world of literal works are? In terms of, I'm trying to find a way.
That's a broad question.
What I'm trying to get at is, do you feel like we're in a similar state as what was perpetuated in the trailer?
Ooh.
Like in terms of where people are kind of,
you're feeding the market.
Yeah,
you're giving into the commerce to make the money.
Yeah, I was taking a long route to get there, but it was getting there.
Yeah, no, yes, and no. Do you know what? I can honestly say the shifting demographic has changed, like, who the readers are focused for, but the content is is becoming more and more, I am here to satisfy the readers who love a good LGBTQ YA, you know, romance novel about these two that happen to meet in a quirky nerd, and I have air quotes, nobody can see it, it's Spencer and Eddie, a quirky nerd way, and that's their meet cute. There has been, and I could think of one off the top of my head that doesn't fully fit that, but there was Book Talk, as TikTok does have, had a book by Travis Baldry. It's basically about an ogre who starts a coffee shop. It's like cinnamon rolls and something, but basically he created this book. Apparently it turned out to be good, mm-hmm. and he's gotten published. He's come to Sacramento. He's
Legends and Lattes.
There we go. Legends and Lattes. He's written a sophomore novel, but after Legends and Lattes came out, suddenly there was a big push for across the market for things that were fantasy based but similar kind of styled. So I do think at this time a lot of that demographic.
Oh, there is a follow up.
Yeah.
Bookshops and Bone Dust.
Exactly. but I feel like it's been shifting in that direction to garner a younger, more fantasy driven like audience. So yes, I feel that there's people that are selling out just to keep, and I don't say selling out, but that are intentionally feeding the market.
They're feeding the market, yeah.
To gain notoriety.
Okay.
And that's something that we can explore within this. But Spencer, my expectations, I didn't have any.
Yeah. and this, Spencer, this is what happens when you say, I don't have any, and I have to come up with a question that was like that. So tell me, Spencer, did you have any expectations? Wink, wink, you better. No, just kidding.
I will say, kinda. yeah, so I remember, I think I was actually talking to you guys while I was half watching the trailer. So like I picked up bits and pieces on it, and like honestly my first thing was like, I hope this isn't just one of those like black, like, you know, torture porn of slavery type movies, because like I've noticed that like there's been a lot of them, like I know like some of them are actually quite good, but I'm like, you know, black people are more than slavery, you know, and so like I'd like to like, you know, because like
that is such a like, That's a very hot button statement to say for a lot of people, because it's just one of those conversation starts where it's like, well, you know, but has it actually ever been recognized fully? But at the same time, it's like, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. It's so like, I was like, oh man, where is this going to go? Because like, honestly, as we approach February, I always get nervous with like movies in February, just throwing that out there. So like, so coming to this, I was like mildly apprehensive, depending on where we actually went, because like I didn't get enough of like what this movie was about from the trailer, which good job on trailer, to really get like if like I should be worried or not.
Yeah. That, I mean, that, and that's such a great point. Like, in terms of expectations, I like Jeffrey Wright. I think Jeffrey Wright's a phenomenal actor. I feel like everything he has done thus far has been amazing. He has been giving like 100% of like all of his effort in every performance he's done that I've seen him in, everything from Westworld all the way to this, even as Uatu in the What If Marvel series. Jeffrey Wright has just been great. Okay. Yes. Amy's looking at me weird. Yes. The Hunger Games as well.
Yes. Because he had a small part, but he was so like ingrained in my brain. I'm like, I like this man.
Which one was he in?
He was
the second one.
So Catching Fire, he was Beatty, and he came from like the technology sector, and his partner was Wyrus, who I think she was in.
She was in Pulp Fiction.
She was one of the robbers in Pulp Fiction.
She was in the beginning.
He did such a good job.
But going back to what I was saying, like Jeffrey Wright does wonderful in every opportunity that we get to see him on screen or hear his voice on screen. The concern that I had was very much rooted in some of the same concerns that Spencer had. Like, I didn't want this to be as the film pitches itself to be, something that is feeding the mainstream for what is going on now. Like, it's almost like you don't want it to have so much meta humor to it that it just loses the point of enjoying the film altogether. Mm-hmm. Like, I get it. There is the machine of consumerism that is out there that will gladly take any opportunity to validate any, you know, any race outside of Black or Hispanic or Asian. You know, the machine will take anything out of that to help validate the feelings of others in an effort for them to not have to worry about understanding or comprehending someone else's plight. And as a Latino, like, I see that a lot in you know, the jokes that are around, or the comedians that are out there that are trying to make white people laugh with jokes that really only technically make sense with Mexicans or people who speak Spanish. Like, but, you know, hey, if they all sound like Speedy Gonzalez, then hey, it's, you know, feeding the masses. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where I wasn't expecting it to get there. I was mm-hmm. just hoping that it wasn't going to, you know, flirt with that edge, because the last thing I wanted to do was to say, I like this movie, asterisk mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, and with everybody that's in this movie, like I said, you had Sterling K. Brown, you know, you had Jeffrey Wright, you had Tracy Ellis Ross, you know, Adam Brody, Issa Rae. With all these different people that were in the movie, you were like, okay, there's a lot of good actors, a lot of, like, not super well-known, but great performers in their own elements that are going to be put together into something else. So, yeah, I think that was my biggest expectation, was for that not to happen. But let's talk about as soon as the film ended. First impressions right out the gate. I want to start with Spencer.
So I cried at the end of the Zhang movie because it just really got to me. Like, especially like third act messaging. Like, yeah. There was a lot of it that was very on point and like very poignant. So like, honestly, I was kind of just like blown away with like how much I liked this movie from like not really hearing terribly much about it.
Yeah. Amy. By the way, Amy, that's how you do a you know, first impression.
Thanks.
Right out the gate.
I really enjoyed this movie, and the third act, I agree with Spencer. I also liked the turn that happened, which I didn't see coming at all, which I think made it even more enjoyable for me. And yeah, I would like to see this movie again, please.
Yeah. I feel like this movie, like I said earlier, I literally got brain stuck in the middle of kind of transitioning, but like, this movie is really hard to explain. And that's not a bad thing. I'm not saying it like a bad thing. I'm saying this movie is like a perfect book where you find yourself enjoying. Like, if ever there was the best way to express every sentiment that you get from a book into a film, and mind you, I'm not talking about like the original where it's based off of. I'm talking about in the nature of like, oh, every person who's ever read, you know, The Hunger Games are like, oh, it's not, you know, the books are so much better than the movie, blah, 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 or whatever, whatnot. Like, this movie felt like it was a full, like, 10-course meal. And it had so much going on in it. And it was so complex and so nuanced. And every aspect of what gem that it was bestowing in between the chaos of this world that was being created by Jeffrey Wright, you know, and his publicist in the movie, or his agent, everything that was going on, all the gems were just so valuable. And everything about this movie, every moment was just a beautiful moment, even if it was hard to watch, you know. And it's not really easy. That's not really something you can easily say about most movies. Most movies, when people get stuck or they get to a point to where they're uncomfortable in a film, the uncomfort is what is the priority emotion. And this movie had scenes that were uncomfortable, but you were invested in the scene and the people who were in it to the point to where you forced yourself to see it for the sake of not just the completion and resolution of the scene, but for the completion and resolution of your connection with those people. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to really look at a movie like this and not find yourself moved. You know, kind of like what Spencer was saying. But speaking of move, let's talk about some of the performers in this film. And obviously, some of the highlights that we got to talk about are, you know, Jeffrey Wright. As I stated, Jeffrey Wright has become an icon, not just vocally, but even as a presence. And this movie even stepped that up to a whole different level. Having seen Jeffrey Wright in moments where he plays the thuggish version of himself, like the quote unquote black version, was so hilarious and so funny. And I kid you not, there were moments where watching Jeffrey Wright's performance in this, I was like, if I was in this role, what would I do to make myself seem more ghetto or whatever? And I'm like, and I'm listening for like that scene. There's a scene where he's with Adam Brody, and then he hears sirens and he starts looking out the window. And obviously we, as the ones who are in the know that he's worried about his mom, but I'm like, oh heck no, he's going to think you're looking for sirens. Oh no, you're about to get busted. You're about, and then obviously he gets up and he runs out. And I'm like, this white boy thinks he's running from the cops. And I'm like, this was written so well. And it's like only somebody like Jeffrey Wright, who has that unique awkwardness, it's almost like a charming awkwardness to his character and to the role, only he could have made it as good as it did in this movie.
Yeah, I can 100% agree with that. And there's something about that, it's this irresistible awkwardness where he's simultaneously dealing with like anger issues and trauma and everything else. And then he quirks a smile and you're like, oh dang, you're actually like having fun. Or you can like, it's Monk is so complex that there's no way really that even in just watching one time through that you will fully be able to kind of explore or understand the full depths of his character. And it's something that Jeffrey Wright embodies perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I got to see it twice. So like that first viewing,
there was,
like,
you don't have to rub it in, Spencer.
Twice. I saw it twice, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the first time I was like, oh, there's so much here. But then the second time it was easier to like focus in on stuff. Mm. And just like the thing about Jeffrey Wright is he can just get like things across in looks.
Yeah.
Like, which is like really impressive, because like you can really tell that he understands his character and his journey and like where he should even be. And I'm just blown away from him, really, because like I feel like the only time I saw him before this was like as Commissioner Gordon, and like, oh my gosh, the only thing I really recognize him from, and that's it.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, that's not bad. I were good with that still. I think the other person that kind of piggybacking off that gives that with a look or embodies their character so deeply is Sterling K. Brown as Cliff. Yes. There is something like, I will be honest, first time I saw Sterling K. Brown was in Black Panther, and I have not watched This Is Us, and same. I'm okay with that.
Sterling K. Brown?
Yeah.
But you saw him in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
That's after Black Panther had come out.
Oh, you mean you hadn't seen him? Okay, previously. Until Black Panther. Okay.
Which in Marvelous Miss Maisel, he does a great job too. Hey. But this was, there is so much heart and life in his performance. And again, another one that this character is so layered and so complex and yearning for so much connection and is being so true to themselves. I'm just like, I just want to hug you. Like, I have no higher praise than, like, can I hug you? Because Sterling K. Brown was moving in such poignant and quiet and beautiful ways. And there was cries for help. There was moments of realization and celebration and yearning. And again, with a look, with a turn, like moving his body. He was literally, and I do not say this to sound cliched, poetry in motion. And I was fixated every time he was on screen. It's just, Oh my gosh.
Yeah, no, he's the one who made me cry.
Good, it was just me.
No, because like, you know, he plays a gay man in this movie, and like I was able to really connect with him as a gay man, like with his journey through like the whole movie. And it really just got to me, especially later on, like in the wedding scene. I was like, gosh, dang it, this guy. But yeah, like another king of looks.
Yes.
Which, by the way, really quick to kind of backtrack, I could have swore you mentioned, Amy, that you've seen Ernest and Celestine.
No, I haven't. Okay. It's an animated show.
Yeah, I thought you had said you'd seen it, but he's Jeffrey Wright's in that.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen Ernest and Celestine. And we were talking about Sterling K. Brown.
And he was also in Lady in the Water.
Oh, I did see Lady in the Water.
I did not.
He was not Mr.
Bad.
Dury.
It's not bad, but it's Paul Giamatti. And had a very
hey, there's nothing wrong with Paul Giamatti.
Bryce Dallas Howard. No, I didn't say there was anything wrong.
It was
the Lady in the Water.
Yeah, she's a Lady in the Water.
It is the M. Night Shyamalan.
But I
being Sterling K. Brown.
I just wanted to mention that. I mean, we did kind of move quickly off of Jeffrey Wright, but I just want to mention, like, Jeffrey Wright is also so much more than just what he's been given opportunities for. And for everyone else who hasn't had a chance to see him in other elements, he's great in the first season of Westworld, if you haven't seen that. He plays Destiny wonderfully in the Sandman podcast
in the audio with James McAvoy. He sounds just so good.
So he's been in a lot of different things. But Sterling K. Brown, you really, and mind you, not everybody wants to see this. I've been telling Amy to watch this for God knows how long. I watched the first couple of seasons of This Is Us. I didn't finish it, but Sterling K. Brown's role in that show absolutely highlights every aspect of where you feel you see him. Like, where you see him now is kind of the explosive version of every part of who he is in that show. If you're unfamiliar, Sterling K. Brown plays the young African American child at the time of Mandy Moore and Milo Vermiglio,
from Heroes.
Yes, the nurse. Yeah. Good job.
But the thing is, he was actually left on the fireman's doorstep and brought to a hospital. And when he was brought to the hospital, at the same time, Mandy Moore and Milo's, Mandy Moore was having her children at the same time. And then Milo was in the hallway and he was looking at the babies. He's standing next to the fireman. The fireman's like, yeah, this one was dropped on our doorstep and blah, blah, blah. And Milo says, we'll take him. He doesn't have a home. We'll take him. Aww. And so this young black kid grows up in this white family. And the great thing about it is the juxtaposition of it flashes back from like when they're young to when they're older now and they're in the current day and age and back and forth. But Sterling K. Brown does an amazing job of just so much emotional nuance and opportunities for him to shine in different aspects. The bigger parts of that series really do highlight who he is as an actor. And I'm not saying that's the only ever place he's ever been, because obviously he does a great job in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and in several other things. He was in Artemis Down, Artemis Hotel. No, that movie with Dave Bautista. It was an action movie. You guys have computers.
Artemis Hotel movie, I remember vaguely, but I don't remember if Dave Bautista was in that.
That's, yep. I am with you on that.
That's wonderful, but you could also help by looking.
I can't.
I was holding so that I could talk about other people that I really liked, but hold on. Artemis Hotel. Not the god.
Hotel Artemis.
There we go.
I was off. It was flipped around. Yeah, both of you guys.
It was a dumb title.
Speaking of which, he was in a movie called A Bunch of Dicks. So anyway, but Sterling K. Brown is such a phenomenal actor. And the great thing is that he's also coming out to being like, he just seems like such a wonderful person. Mm. And
oh my gosh, yes.
And the pride that he had in this movie, talking about it. Even though, to my surprise, I thought, honestly, when I was hearing him talk about it, I thought he was like a producer. I thought he was like a director. I thought he was like somebody leading this film. And he's just, not that his role isn't important, but he's not as big of a role as everyone else. But he still has this pride in it, that he's a part of it. And his role is vital, no matter how less of screen time he may have, how much more we would have wanted. He is still a vital, important part of this film. And it's just, his role in this movie was so, it was so real and so honest as anyone could be about family. Mm-hmm. Like, I think one of the best moments that highlights that is, you know, when after he leaves his brother and his brother's girlfriend, and he's going to the car to supposedly go back to the airport to go back home, and his brother's girlfriend, Monk's girlfriend, says, you know, it's nice meeting you, and you figure he's going to turn and say something kind back, and he turns and says, this family will break you. It will break your heart.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, like that's an honest statement of somebody who just has nothing left in the tank for the definition of family, you know. And it's a very real and emotional moment in the film, even though it doesn't play off as it, because you know everything that has built up to that moment. Yeah, Sterling K. Brown's just phenomenal. Mm-hmm. So, was there anybody else you wanted to highlight since you had room for other people, Amy?
I do. I have three more people. Two of them I can kind of bunch together, but this one I wanted. But I want to talk. I'm not bunching those two together for a particular reason. You'll find out. But this one, Tracy Ellis Ross,
yes!
as Lisa. She's the sister. I felt literally like this is. I want to hang out with her. I want to spend time with her. I want to just be around her. Her light, her presence, her, she was everything that makes, when you have a good relationship with a sibling, I saw that reflected in her performance opposite Jeffrey Wright and opposite Sterling K. Brown. No, we didn't even get to see her with Sterling K. Brown, did we?
No, because Sterling K. Brown's character was in Arizona.
It was in Arizona, but she had like this, it was so, again, we're going to talk about earnest performances and genuine performances. These are not trigger or buzzwords. They're literally the only words I can come to think of where I can connect without just making random noises of excitement and flailing my arms. She's genuine. And it feels like of everything that's going wrong within their family unit, she is the one that is continuing to try to just keep it together. And she's there to support her brother and love on her brothers. Mm. And it's like, I just want to spend time with her. Like being around her, you see Jeffrey Wright's Monk like relax the anger that's living inside of him, that is constantly eating at him with his high expectations for himself, seem to be dampened when he's around his sister, who is just like, she calls him on his BS, but she still loves him. And there's no expectation other than it's her brother. And her joke is probably one of the dumbest, most amazing jokes I have heard to date. And she's an OBGYN in the movie, so it makes it even better.
Fun fact, that joke actually is in the book.
Yes!
From Lisa, too.
That's funny. It's a straight-up dad joke, but she does a great job telling it. So, Spencer, was there anyone else you wanted to highlight?
Okay, I would like to highlight Erica Alexander. She is like from my childhood. So each time she just pops into something, I'm like, it's you! You're back again. So like, I was just super happy to see her. And like, you know, like she doesn't have like, you know, well, at least it doesn't feel like it's a long time in the movie, but like, she has a strong presence and a very likable character, and I'm just happy to see her again.
Yes. Yeah.
No, it was definitely a fun time to actually see her. You're right. Like, I remember when she was on Living Single.
Yes.
You know, when she used to, you know, be on, I remember that show. Everything about it was, she was just a funny actress.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything else, she's like intermittently, like the last time I remember seeing her in a movie was in Get Out.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I was, great. Yeah, she was absolutely great. Just setting up that guy, what's his name, to keep talking, and everyone starts laughing. See, don't say I don't give you anything. But she is such a calming presence for the entire film, even for that family. She is essentially our the audience's perspective on the family, you know, in the film itself. And it's a great opportunity to see not only a character like that in the movie, but to see her do it so well. Like, there's no doubt in my mind, she is still a great actress. She is still going to be a great actress, and I would hope to see her in more things after the fact, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I don't think we have time for any more Ames. I'm sorry. We don't, because it's, no, we don't have time.
But it's Lorraine and Maynard.
They're great actors. Okay.
They're brilliant, and they're sweet, and keep going.
Okay,
watch
we
the
mostly
movie.
Didn't like, there's like almost nobody we didn't like.
Yeah, that, I mean, I think like, it's safe to say, yeah, there was nobody that we didn't like. I think everybody in the film played their roles so well that if we were meant to, that if we were meant to not like them, we weren't going to like them. If we were meant to gravitate to them or have some kind of, you know, resemblance or even affinity towards them, we did. I mean, everything from every, you know, judge on the book peoples to every single, you know, every single actor in the film, they were like the right kind of cringe, the right kind of like, ugh, and everything. But speaking of cringe and everything, let's talk about the story itself. And I don't mean cringe in a bad way, because honestly, there are moments in this movie that you're like, oh my God, if this really actually happened, I would probably hide under a desk. The story is pretty straightforward. Because of his disgust with everything going on in the literary world, Jeffrey Wright's character, Monk, decides to write a treatment or a story that is satirical to what is already out there, feeding into the mass consumerism of quote-unquote black literature, and ends up getting picked up, and everything kind of steamrolls down a very steep hill very, very fast. I think one of the best things I like about this story and this film is its pacing. It is not a massive, like, bullet train downhill kind of thing. It is a slowly unraveling, you know, giant ball of chaos that isn't going down the steep hill, but it's this hill that's slowly gaining momentum as it continues to move down, like slowly. It doesn't put it all in your face, but it does let you realize the tension is there. The stress, the frustration, all of it based in real world situations. I mean, who hasn't had the conversation about, you know, a loved one who, you know, may need special care, or the fact that you don't have the funds to take care of certain things, and the choice between whether or not to do the morally right thing or the financially right thing. Like, those are always really difficult things to come about. I'm not saying everyone's got struggles with whether or not they're going to be a drug dealer today or not, but I'm just saying, you know, those questions do pop up in regular people's lives. And this movie made that relatable in this situation. As ridiculous as this story is, the elements of plight that everybody faces in this are real moments.
Yeah.
And I love how the treatment itself, Cord Jefferson, who adapted the novel, really created a world that is, it's black and white, no pun intended. It is literally about this. Like, the conversation that the head of the awards committee has with Jeffrey Wright's character, Monk, and he goes, you know, so I reached out to the one black author who I know probably wouldn't have a this and that about, you know, about whatever. And Jeffrey Wright's like, well, thank you for bringing me in as the one black person who isn't going to have a huge fit about it or whatever. Like, the way that conversation goes, it's like, yeah, I think if those conversations were honest, that's how they would sound. And there's literally like things like that. Like, we just literally had the Emmys and the BAFTAs and everything else, and conversations of race and everything else are still happening, you know, every day. Quite literally, all these people are now going through and combing through every single one of Ayo Edebiri's letterboxed reviews about movies, because she is such a fan about movies. If you're not familiar with who Ayo Edebiri is, she was the April O'Neil character in the Ninja Turtle movie that just recently came out. She has also won several awards for her role in the second season of FX's The Bear. But because she won so many awards, now people are like, oh, well, she must think she's hot this and this is not. And there, she has a Letterboxd account where, if you don't know what a Letterboxd account is, it's an account where you can just give casual reviews of films that you've seen in just short spurts. Mm-hmm. They're not anything really, you know, insane. It's just, yeah, I saw this movie, liked it, blah, blah, blah. And she has a massive account. And people are going through and, like, literally just giving her the, you know, the business with how she's pitted a lot of her reviews, which...
It's her personal opinion.
Yeah, exactly. So I say all that to say, like, it's still something that's going on today. And just this movie has the cojones to just put it in black and white out there like that. Yeah, I really did appreciate the way the flow of this story and the way it was, like, structured. I didn't feel at any point in time, I didn't feel overwhelmed to the point to where, like, obviously the character is overwhelmed, but, like, I didn't feel overwhelmed by the elements of the story to where I still didn't get a chance to enjoy what was happening on screen. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that goes back to my metaphor of, or not my metaphor, but my parallel to this being equal to reading a great book in full. Like, in when you read a great book, you can pace it yourself. You know how to step by step turn the page, go through each chapter. If you can't do more than two chapters in a single sitting, then you wait and you come back to it and so forth. And the completion of the book is, you know, it's fulfilling. It's holistically fulfilling as well as, like, accomplishing the effort of finishing a book. That's how I felt with this movie. It really gave me the mindset of, like, the pacing and everything made it feel like the movie felt complete.
Yeah. Well, and I can also see there were moments in this where those pauses that we talk about with Miyazaki, where he gives the space for you to linger on something. There were moments of lingering on the grass at the beach or on trees, or these moments of quiet reflection and solitude that let you catch your breath. Because I was thinking about it today that if we had removed those and we were going from the just sheer mental chaos of Monk being his, you know, Stagger Lee, his pen name character in those, and then jumping straight to family drama, how the pacing, how it would feel, and how, like, not only butted together, but, like, how disjointed it would have been. Mm-hmm. And those moments of quiet transition between them, literally, I was catching myself, like, taking a breath where I'm like, okay, this is really neat. And I appreciated it. And I don't know if that's solely Cord Jefferson, right?
Yes. Yeah, the director and writer.
Yeah, if that was entirely just his direction, or also was part of editing and the cinematography that went together in such a completely harmonious way that, yeah, I was just like, oh, I like this. This is nice.
Yeah. And mind you, like, honestly, the way... I think this is more of a question for Spencer, if I'm now reflecting on my thoughts. How does the pacing of the book fill out? Like, when you were listening to it, or when you read it, when you consumed the book. Let's put it that way, when you consumed it.
Okay, the book. Okay. So the pacing of the book is it's a bit different, because, like, the book, like, will go into, like, what I'm assuming are stories that Thelonious is also writing.
Oh, okay.
So, like, it'll be yada-da-da-da, like, about the actual story, and then we just, like, take, like, a hard write. It's a bit, like, the book actually, like, is a bit disjointed, because, like, you're following around, and just then it's all of a sudden, it's like, oh, I've now gone onto a different track.
Ah, okay.
And, like, you know, it takes a second, especially if it's just, like, a few parts where I'm, like, I need to keep rewinding to fully take in what Thelonious is going, because, like, he is a very smart man, so, like, he will just go to task very quickly about mm-hmm. something, and then I'm like, I need more time than this to, like, really absorb what you're saying. The book is a lot. It also, so in the movie, there is a very brief section where we actually go into my pathology.
Yes.
And it's brilliantly done with, like, two actors in a room, like, just kind of talking with Jeffrey Wright. In the book, it's half the book. It's is my pathology.
No.
Just to get how insane this whole thing is. Because like the brief snippet in like the movie, I'm like, okay, I could kind of see that being like a thing somewhere. The actual book, it's garbage. It is so bad. It's amazing how bad it is. And like the second that we flip back into the real world, his author's calling him. He's like, that'll be $600,000 they want to give you for this. And you're kind of just floored because like you've been thrusted into a world that you just didn't want to be in. And it was awful. But like, you're also kind of wondering, where are we going with this? It was just really interesting.
I have a question.
Sure.
Is the dad character in my pathology, I can't even say it with a straight face, mm-hmm. pathology, is his name actually Willy the Wonker?
It's Willy. It might be something slightly different. Okay. I remember it was like he was a drunk or something. It might be Wonker, though.
Yeah, because I looked at the cast list and it said Willy the Wonker. And I was like, hold up. Hold up.
Willy the Wonker, yeah.
And then the one that's playing his son is Van Gogh Jenkins.
Yeah, that's his name in the book.
Oh, my God.
They call him Go, or like one person called him Van. So like the book version of my pathology is just like beating your head against the wall. But like, I don't also want to like diss the author of it because it's very interesting.
Oh my gosh.
It sounds like I have to admit, and I was going to mention this in my highlights, that scene alone
was stunning, phenomenal.
I love that scene. The fact that you have Keith David, who plays Willy the Wonker, in that scene, and the way it just plays out, and even how it like Keith David at one point in time is like turns back and is like, no, I can say that better. Write it again. I can say it better. I can say it better. Mm. And it's just like Jeffrey Wright's like kind of like, okay. And he, you know, erases and he rewrites it. The way the whole thing plays out is just so satirically funny,
mm-hmm.
like pertaining to every single show out there that tries to do that. Like, this was great, and I love that scene, and I love that element of the story. I don't know if I would have wanted to see more of it in that element. It might have like disrupted the whole thing, kind of turned it to like a schizophrenic nightmare.
Before I read the book, I was like, yeah, they should have done slightly more of my pathology. After reading the book, I'm like, no, that was the right amount.
Yeah,
like, they made the right choice.
Yeah.
Also, that was that was in the book too.
That sequence was in the book.
Yes, it was.
Oh, which one?
Gosh.
The one where he's like, look at my black hands.
my black lips.
I'm your daddy and you know it. Yes. Also, I need to briefly talk about something else that happened during this movie. Near the beginning, we get introduced to, what was her name? Sinestra Golding?
Yes.
Yeah.
Or Sintara Golding?
Sintara
Golding, yeah.
And her book title broke me. Like, I just saw it and I was like, what is happening? Wheezed? Wheeze?
Mm-hmm.
Wheeze lives in the ghetto. Like, I stopped hearing the movie as I was just processing this title of a book. It was crazy.
Yes.
So.
Agreeing.
No.
You gonna go pharmacy?
So, when I was younger.
Oh, God.
I wrote a story.
No! Did you?
Wait, I need to hear this for everyone that doesn't know.
I was young,
mm-hmm.
and it was so. Thankfully, it wasn't a ghetto story. But okay. Like when you live in South Texas, and the Mexicans are the most Mexican, and the white people are the most white people, you tend to go to one side to get inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, the next year I went to the Mexican side, I did a short story on the perspective of the Battle of the Alamo from the side of the Mexican soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
A year earlier, I actually wrote a short story about a essentially countrified little white boy who couldn't spell well, and every single word was phonetically written in the short story about the story of John and his little brother who was born special.
Eddie!
Hold on, talk amongst yourself. Let me see if I can find it.
Oh, you got a copy!
You have a copy still!
I don't want to know about this copy, because he's going to read it like, I think that was the part, yeah, the title. I was just like, left field. Also, the cover of the book with the shoes hanging off the wire. I was like, no. But then when she started, when Issa Rae started reading it.
Which is in the book, that exact sequence.
That is so, it was such a, like, not only a juxtaposition, but when she starts reading it, you're just like, I axed her. I'm like,
yeah.
Oh, it's actually in your book like that. Oh, and then when we get to that confrontation between her and Monk about the contents of her book.
Oh, you mean when she did a lot of research?
Exactly. Table flip. Oh.
Yeah, I was like, what do you mean you did any research? What?
Oh my gosh. And she's like, I did a lot of research. And some of those were actually taken from. And I was like, oh. But you could have. Why?
Yeah, because like I totally thought, I guess maybe because we were so focused on Monk, I just thought she was a shill who knew what she was doing.
Yeah.
But when we come to that part, I was like, oh no, this is somehow worse.
Yeah, that's like,
I don't know where this story is at. Thank God.
Yeah, I was a bit worried.
I was a bit worried.
Watch it in a Dropbox somewhere. We can't find it.
Oh, that's right.
Oh no! Just kidding.
Like, no, but yeah, that also took me for a loop. Like, you figure the big spin is like, ultimately, several like black authors are just doing this as a shill because they've all gotten to the same point to where Monk is at. Like that was what I was hoping. Like that was going to be the big turn. Like all of a sudden, Monk realizes that every single black author that is out there in this world, including, and if he mentions like Tyler Perry, Oprah Winfrey, all these other people, like he was going to like. Sintara was going to say like, yeah, we all do this. We all have to feed the wheel. We all have to feed the machine so that way we can, you know, I feel like the conversation that Monk has with his agent is the worst thing and the best thing to happen.
The Johnny Walker.
Yeah.
The Johnny Walker analogy, which was brilliant. I hate it so much, but it was 100% true.
It's 100% true. But it's the worst thing that is a truth in the industry today, mm-hmm. in any industry, in that you can aspire to be somebody who creates art, but every now and then you can create trash because it sells. And if you sell trash, then it just keeps feeding the bucket to where you can continue to make art. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, because then that just lowers the standard of what you're going to consider art versus what you're going to consider trash.
Is this like the Hugh Grant conundrum? The man just keeps feeding the trash wheel.
Because no, no. Hugh Grant is just trash now at this point. But yeah, like I was hoping for that turn. And then the fact that it just comes out that, no, I'm blinded as well. I've been in this system I feel like I'm justified in doing this. This book is whatever it is, and your anger and whatever, it's unfounded because you feel like you're black and you're a man that you can do whatever. But I am entitled to do this.
Yeah.
It was
that, because at this point in the movie, Sintara and everybody else on the literacy book panel for the judges don't know that this is Monk's book.
Right.
And both I almost keep saying
Sintara.
Sintara. I almost said Sinatra, and I'm like, nope, that's not her name. Sintara is saying that she's against this book, and she's like, no, I feel it's contrite. It's totally satirical.
It's pandering. It's
and Monk's excited because he's like, yeah, somebody finally gets it, and everybody else is like, goo goo gaga about it, but. When they have a conversation and he's like, hey, can you tell me what you didn't like? And she says, oh, those other things. And he's like, well, how is it different from yours? And she's like, well, excuse me, I did my research. And then you start thinking about it. She went and he pointed out she went to a college, like, and he called it a hippie college.
A bohemian college.
A bohemian college, thank you. And that she quit a job at a very prominent publishing company to research, and I air quoted this, and Spencer's gonna say it all day, but research this and interview people to make this, to feed the wheel. And she's like, and it's fine because this is what people want. And it's like, she has the ability to make art as defined by Monk, but is intentionally choosing to feed the wheel,
yeah,
and not pursue anything, which brings up one of my absolute favorite quotes in this movie, and I'm saving it for later. Yeah.
Just say it. We're literally...
I have a quote list.
Yeah, you have the quote list too. It's